Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 22 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, a tome called the with a subtitle The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. We're up to page page 330-ish odd of an 850-page tome on it. And he's given various things, looking at the sun in the air, skin, ocean. It would be nice if he actually just gave simple words like this. But this one is part four, Harnessing the Sun. And it shows someone, a pope, on the top of a man striding across, an English print. And it's written like this. So this is not the chapters, this is the first time. When Elizabeth I of England received the papal bull in 1582, astronomers urged her to make the change to the new Georgian calendar, while Protestants' bishops opposed it. This 1641 engraving, the Father Time carrying the Pope on his back to Rome, catches the popular mood. As the poem beneath image put it, the load is vanity, this peddler's pack, this trunk of trash. It's interesting. I think the Eastern Orthodox didn't adopt the Gregorian calendar till much later. So it's interesting that Pope Gregory was actually a astronomer, or had interest in the heavens. However, it's also interesting how astrology and astronomy, you need the sort of the pop science as part of the ecosystem of it. This chapter is 19, The Heavenly Guide. An embassy, Emily Dickinson, 1862. Oh, sorry. Herman Melville, 1851. I think he was an explorer. There's Melville Island. Okay, let's listen to it. It looks Ahab is Moby Dick, isn't it? Oh, okay. Ahab soon calculated what his latitude must be at the precise instant. Then, falling into a moment's reverie, he again looked upward towards the sun and murmured to himself, "Thou sea mark, thou high and mighty pilot, thou tellest me truly where I am, but canst thou at least hint where I shall be?" Okay, Emily Dickinson. And the sailor cannot see north, but he knows the needle can. Captain Ahab can be forgiven for his moment of frustration. "The emptiness and homogeneity of the sea," writes Daniel Boston, "the vast sameness of the ocean on the surface naturally drove sailors to seek their bearings from the heavens. And the sun's role in guiding such travellers has long been history. The oldest proven sea travel anywhere is the migration of the anatomically modern Homo sapiens to Australia." Oh, gee, that's really sick. "Beginning about 60,000 years ago, there must have been the most impressive sea voyages of old were the Polynesians, who by around 2000 BC had already made themselves the formidable astronomers." They also used wave technology, I think it's the major thing. "The sun was part of was their principal marker, but usually in relation to other stars, the position of which they memorized in the hundreds. The Chinese were not far behind, calling their blue water junks starry crafts." "The ancient Greeks too became seafarers, although Homer engagingly introduces a talkative bald-headed seaman who set the crew laughing and forgot his course. And the Greeks had no native word for sea when their invasions broke into the Mediterranean." It's interesting they didn't have no word for the sea and no actual word for the sky's blue. No one's ever made a comment about the blue sky in ancient lines in any culture. But sailors who left sight of land were constantly groping their way forward. Even on short voyages, men were often at sea, as well as, say, seafarers gloomily swapped stories of those who had fallen foul of the Mediterranean weather. From the Spartan king Menelaus, whose homebound fleet was blown from Troy to Egypt, to St. Paul's shipwreck in Malta. The lack of a mean to determine longitude, east-west positioning presented an often insurmountable challenge. The directions by which we position ourselves, north, south, east, west, are set from two coordinates, horizon and zenith. The horizon, the Greek defining or separating, Greek for defining or separating, is the line where the earth and sky appear to meet. The zenith, Arabic means over one's head, is a point of the sky immediately above the observer. These two lateral and vertical point, a plane and lateral point, provide our initial frame of reference. Man learned to assign the values east, west, south to rising, setting objects in the sky, calling the directions of the line at right angles to their course north and south. Eventually invented meridians, imaginary lines which curve through any given point on Earth's surface to mark the shortest distance between them and the poles. One's own meridian is nothing more than a north-south line that runs through a particular spot where you happen to be. At any given point, one of the meridians is exactly underneath the sun, making it noon for everyone standing along it. For those who to the east, the afternoon or later, for those to the west, morning or before, and halfway around the world in either direction is midnight. Beautifully put, isn't it? This absolutely beautifully written. Points on the same meridian have the same longitude, longitude being measured as the distance east or west of the standard meridian, which since 1884 has been accepted, passing through Greenwich, south east of London, which we have to say is Greenwich is actually at the wrong position because they used a plumb bob, and plumb bob didn't point down vertically. Early navigators could roughly determine east and west of the sun's rising and setting. Later, seafarers developed other aids, knowing the latitude, north-south alignment of the ship's position was easy, for the sun's altitude was almost the perfect guide. 1 degree latitude is about 65 nautical miles, and 1 nautical mile equaling 1.15 statute miles, or 1.85 kilometres. At the equinox, on the noonday sun is directly above the equator, or at an altitude of 90 degrees. While at the poles, it is invisible in the hemisphere's winter, but clearly seen in summer. In between the pole, the equator and pole, the sun's noon's altitude can be established and compared with the astronomical tables to determine one position. The only device needed is a sighting instrument to measure the altitude in degrees. The Greeks did not even use that, but simply measured the height of a circumpolar star above the horizon at night. The art of navigation evolved over centuries with certain notable breakthroughs, not all of which related to the orientation of the sun. In AD 40, the Greek merchant Hippalus sailed from Bernice on the Red Sea coast of Egypt to Madras and back in a single year, a journey that had previously taken two, thus helping transform the oceanic commerce. He had discovered the monsoon winds from Man Morswin, Arabic for season. Oh, that's what the seasonal winds. Isn't that amazing? I'll pick that up. What are some of the ghosts and gas? Marigold, flower clocks and stuff like that. Thereafter, the Greeks became so accustomed to using the names of the winds to indicate the directions from which they came, that the wind became the synonym for direction, which, with the puffed cheeks, exhaled strong breath of the cherubs on the early maps were not merely directions, but the main direction markers, hence Australia, land of the south wind. That's a piece of important thing. Columbus. Australia means land of the south wind. The Columbus Spanish cruise, that's an interesting cruise, thought direction not in terms of degrees of the compass, but in Los Ventos, the winds, while the Portuguese called their compass card Rosa de Ventos, a wind rose, duly marked off with the most significant aspects of the sky. Critics have pointed out several errors in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, but his note about rose line is to the point. For centuries, he writes, the symbol of the rose had been associated with maps as guiding souls in the proper direction. The compass rose, drawn in every match, indicated north, east, south, west. Originally known as the wind rose, it denoted directions of 32 winds, 16 quarter winds. When diagrammed inside a circle, these 32 points of the compass perfectly resembled a traditional 32-petaled rosal boom. Oh, okay. To this day, the fundamental navigation tool was still known as the compass rose. A northmost direction still marked with an arrowhead, or more commonly, the symbol of the fleur-de-lis. Winds, of course, are primarily solar. As the Middle Age opened, say, by Charlemagne's time, 1800, Arab navigators gauged latitude either by the kamal, a wooden rectangle on a string, or a crossbow in which two rods were hinged at one end to measure the angle of declination when observed levelled at the bottom of a rod, the horizon lay up at the sun of the star. Then, in 1086, the magnetic compass was pioneered by the Chinese waterworks director. Wow! Shen Kai, at least. He offers the first source. For the first time, Chinese sailors were able to find an absolute direction anywhere on the globe without complicated calculations, and were provided with, and in Boston's words, a worldwide absolute for space comparable to which Mikhail clock and uniform hour provided for time. Shen Kua further advised that if one rubbed a thin piece of steel on a lodestone, stone that leads, and hung it on a thread, the magnetic needle would point almost south. Although the lodestone is simply a piece of ore possessing magnetic properties, its remarkable power was for a long time associated with the dark arts. In China, such stones were used for fortune-telling. The common seamen were wary of it. St. Augustine recounts to his amazement on seeing magnetite could not only attract iron, but give it the power to attract yet more, creating it a claim held together by an unseen force, hence the association with magic. The origin of this wondrous new instrument are still hotly debated. Historians disagree on whether it was invented or more or less simultaneously in several places, or whether European Arabs learned it from the Chinese. But the wondrous though it was, its authority could be undone by extreme weather conditions, a truth that rang through the centuries. From at least the 11th century, most ships' pilots had manuals to help them, the best pilot book to survive, such time being the Chronos Sagia, the King's Mirror, written as a dialogue between a Viking father and a son. The youth is told he must observe the course of the heavenly bodies, recognise the quarters for the horizon, mark the movements of the ocean, and understand the rise and fall of tides. However, the ability to establish the sun's position is not sufficient for good navigation. Must be supplemented. When crossing the open sea, Vikings could gauge latitude by means of sun shadow board, a wooden disc with a pin or gorman at the center that could be adjusted upwards or downwards according to the season. The disc floated a bowl of water and the sun's noon shadow noted. If the ship was on course, explained Robert Ferguson in his Parakistry of Vikings, then the shadow would reach the circle marked on the board. If it passed beyond the ship's north of its latitude, if it should fail to reach the circle, it was south, and the skipper would make necessary adjustments. Nevertheless, without sure reckoning of latitude, the navigation of the Vikings' great voyages principally depended on deep acquaintance with the seas they were crossing. For longer voyages, a pilot would put himself on the latitude of his destination, then try to hold course by keeping to observe angles of land where available. Just like little bodies uniform. Not surprisingly, he often missed the destination, which is how the Vikings winded up long of the wonderful up on the long and wonderful beaches of Greenland and Labrador. Well, it's not necessarily so. Oh, they would have known it. They knew Greenland before. Another school the Vikings may have employed is using a sunstone, a clump of a natural crystal, to polarise the light and thereby locate the sun even when it was hidden from view. The Viking sunstone is believed by many to have been a form of chorodite, a mineral found almost exclusively on the pebbly beaches of Norway, which can be split, which can split a light beam into two shafts of color. When held up against a clear patch of sky, and rotated, it changes from yellow to blue at the moment it is pointed towards the hidden sun. A story, Rudolf Star, preserved in a manuscript from the early 14th century, tells of a visit by Olav Haraldsson, king of Norway, to a rich farmer. Olav asked his host's son, Sigurd, if he had any special talent. The boy replies that he can tell the time, even when there's no celestial body visible. Intrigued, the king next morning challenges Sigurd to demonstrate his skill against the overcast sky. Once the youth has done so, Olav orders him to hold up the sunstone in the direction he believes the sun to be. Sunlight streams through the prism, verifying Sigurd's gift. Footnote. There are several ways to determine direction of the sun or the stars. One is the shadow method, tip method, putting a straight stick about 3 foot long on the ground so that it stands upright. Mark the tip of the shadow so cast, then wait till the shadow moves 1.5 to 2 inches between 10 to 15 minutes. Then mark the tip of the second shadow. Draw a line from the first mark to the second mark about a foot beyond the second, then stand with your left foot on the left and in the northern hemisphere temperate zone, you will be facing in the northern direction. If in the southerly, you'll be facing the opposite. Okay, I don't think that's exactly correct. More conventional aids were improving all the time. A compass with a graduated scale was worked over 360 degrees, as mentioned by Peter Marcotte in 1269. Judging from the British ship account books, most vessels had at least two compasses, Magellan carrying 35 replacement needles aboard his flagship. The fact that the north arrow of a compass does not, in most places, point to pole either east or west, thereby by spread that the sailors termed the variation, was early detected. But such inexactitude was not properly quantified until 1490, and precautionary bearers are still taken of the sun as it rises and setting, as well as the 17th century. From 1480 on, a mariner's astrolabe was used to calculate the sun's noon altitude, so determine the observer's distance north and south of the equator. Such a version, a ring marked with degrees for measuring celestial altitude, was followed by a cross staff, a nearly 3 foot long piece of wood marked with graduated measurements with a perpendicular vane that slid back and forth on it, and the back staff and back quadrant, together with the main navigational instruments until the invention of the octant in 17, so there's the astrolabe and the octant in 1731. Timothy Ferris begins such sightings and brings such sightings to life. Here's a quote. Okay, I'm just looking where the footnote is here. At local noon of any clear day aboard a ship of the line, three officers could be seen helping to shoot the sun, one holding an astrolabe steady, another sighting, and a third reading the elevation, while the deckhand stood to catch the navigator when he fell, or to retrieve the astrolabe if it were dropped when scuttling across the rolling deck. Okay, I don't know what this footnote's for. Okay, in Don Quixote, 1605, Cervantes makes his feeling plain about the people's general ability to use all newfangled gadgetry. Quixote, which surnames Catalan translates as horse's ass, isn't that beautiful, is busy expounding to his long-suffering groom how Ptolemy remains the great authority of navigation, and how he, the Don, might pinpoint their position had he the right equipment at hand. And I'll finish the quote, but I've got this footnote here. And I can't see where it's a footnote from. Oh, yes. It's at the very top. I missed it. The variation at the top. The Arctic has five North Poles. One, the North Geographic Poles at 90 degrees. This is fixed axis ahead of the Earth. Two, the magnetic North Pole. The compasses point to it, but wanders about. The North Celestial Pole, the sky directly above one. Yes, son? Okay, picking up podcasting. I was interrupted. Well, not interrupted, but it's great. One of the joys was taking my daughter to school early on. Okay, so we're Don Quixote. I can't pronounce them properly. I used to be able to say it when I was a kid. When I was a small boy, I had little comic books of him about him being caught on a windmill and all this type of stuff. It'd be probably worthwhile. They're quoting from this person. The Don might pinpoint their position had he the right equipment to hand. If only I had an astrolabe, he proclaims, which I could take the heart of the pole, I could tell you how far we've gone. Sancho Panza gloomily retorts, my God, but your worship has got a pretty fellow for a witness of what you say. This name, Ptolemy, whatever you call him, with his amputation. I don't quite understand that. For once, contemporary readers may well have laughed in sympathy with Quixote. John, Don Quixote. I used to be able to say it. New instruments, possibly because, like compasses, they are associated with black arts, are slow in coming into general use. It has been said that navigators were the only surviving upholders of the Ptolemaic theory. Not because they believed in the sun went round the earth, but because it was simpler to consider that it did. And Jonathan Spence makes the point that by the beginning of the 17th century, no benefits from exploration of the heavens opened up by Copernicus had yet applied to the art of navigation. Astrolabes passed out of fashion because they were never that precise. They were replaced by orreries, clockwork models for planetary systems. But be it compasses, astrolabes, quadrants, sextants, telescopes, or orrery, none was perfect. The sailors still needed to know how to use their own first-hand observation of the sun to calculate their position. Well, I would say it was perfect. Cook got it perfect, but no one else got close. Even in the event of a telescope and the sister instruments did not put an immediate end to the naked eye astronomy, since it was not easy to make accurate positional observations until crosshairs were incorporated into telescopes in the 1660s, and that's an important thing. Thus, a huge weight of responsibility lay on lonely pilots, Spence goes on, armed with whatever experience they had of the winds and the currents, fish movements and the birds' flights, carrying simple maps and narratives of previous voyages when they existed. With compasses, astrolabes, quadrants, pilots took responsibility for vessels for thousands of tons or more, with no more than 1,000 passengers and a crew, with more than 1,000 passengers and crew jammed aboard. As Ferdinand Bordel describes in the 16th century voyages, navigation in those days was a matter of following the shoreline, just as the earliest days of water transport, moving crab-wise from rock to rock, from promontory to island, and from island to promontory. As a Portuguese chronicler puts it, of travelling from one seaside into another, dining in one and supping at the next. In exceptional circumstances, a ship might lose sight of the coast, where she blown off course, or set on one or three or four direct routes long known and used, but rarely did ships take a voluntary to the open sea. There's a footnote here, a fairly big footnote, not too much. Outside the Mediterranean, there existed one further difficulty that the sailor on the inland sea could ignore tides. As George Darwin recognised, the construction of trustworthy tide tables is crucial for navigation. On the other hand, the use of a shipman's log menage had by the 16th century developed into a fine art, and there would have been a few spots on the main routes where the depth and nature of the ocean bed were unknown. Okay, and this Darwin is Darwin's grandson who did things on time. The threats to avoid under a greater penalty were storms and piracy, regarded for centuries as quite honourable profession. The piracy. The Mediterranean at Birdal has never been inhabited by a profusion of seagoing peoples found in the northern seas of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. But Brindle's view has come under challenge. Historians pointing out that as early as the day of Alexander the Great, a new era of navigation was the beginning with the construction of lighthouses, which during the same period, rigging and steering gear were also improved, so the sea captains began to sail directly from the destinations instead of hugging the coast. Now, this is true, the Great Lighthouse of Alexandria, you could have picked that one. Birdal's classic first appeared in 1949 and 55, a commodore of the Admiralty in the foreword to the history of sea navigation, not mentioning Birdal by name, delivered this broadside against the rock-scratching theory. In these pages, you will find disproved once and for all that precedent myth that the first sailors navigated by hugging the shore. Those words should never have been written by a sailor. Nothing is more fraught with peril, and therefore more assiduously avoided, than a little-known coast than hugging the shore. The myth is based on the assumption that the mariner had neither means nor ability to find his way without sight of land. Now, this assumption is shown to be groundless. Also, it takes no account of the extra sense and undoubtedly ability of small ship sailor to know where he is with remarkable accuracy without instrument and observation. In fact, that many deep sea fishermen have this ability in some measure today, and it may well be in being more commonplace than days gone by. Nothing is more sure, by whatever means they achieved it, that sailors of all ages have navigated in deep waters. Nonetheless, the grand French historian made no alteration to later editions. Okay, but whatever the route, sea travel remained unpredictable. In 1551, recorded as a certain ship which, without ever striking sail, arrived at Naples from Deprana in Sicily in 37 hours, a distance of 200 sea miles, the writer ascribing such swift motion to the power of violent floods and outrageous winds. Without such unusual conditions, Sicily to Rome, 800 miles, still took 20 to 27 days. My God. And outside the Mediterranean, traffic was even slower. The 276 miles from Bernice to the peninsula of Insula, for instance, consumed up to 6 months, much less than 1 mile an hour. During such a voyage, the sun remained one reliable helpmate. The geographer Richard Cowart would still write in 1598 that no kind of men in any profession on the Commonwealth passed the years in so great and continual hazard of life, or so many, so few grow to grey hairs. Instruments that made use of the sun had another ally in safe navigation, reliable and semi-reliable maps. Such aids had been employed in the one form or another for centuries, yet the first mention of a chart being used aboard a ship comes only in 2070, when sainted Louis IX, King of France, attempted to cross directly from the south of France to Tunis on a crusade, found himself driven by a storm to take refuge at Calgary Bay in the Sardinian coast. To allay his fears, the crew produced a map showing him exactly where they were. As world shrank and trade grew, accurate versions of the Earth's surface were prized as they were rare. The most map makers mixed fiction, fact, and superstition. Some 600 charts survived from the Middle Ages. Ecumenical maps, as they were known, for they aimed to show ecumene, a whole inhabited world. All circular, with Jerusalem in the centre. Ptolemy's 27 charts drawn up for his geography in AD 150 had been lost, but they were rediscovered in the 15th century and wildly copied, yet they treated the Earth as if it was a flat surface. These are plain charts, while we originally get plain sailing. Oh, so that plain sailing means that I'm sailing on a chart. Oh my God, regularly led sailors astray, a failing of which not all the beautiful embellishment of the artist could compensate. Gerard de Cremer, who became Gerus Macrator, this is the map, Rupel Mondlos, 1512-1911, when he matriculated at the Flemish University of Leuven, resolved the difficulty of how to most nearly reproduce the spherical world on flat piece of paper. His famous projection, which is the metrical projection, extends the curves, the latitude and longitude onto plane surfaces. There were other projections before metricals, but his allowed lines of fixed bearings to render as straight lines, which made the course plotting easier. His maps, like those of his contemporaries, were often highly classified, considered by governments to be instruments of imperial power. To copy them, share them to foreigners was treated as a capital offence. You'd get killed. Well, by the year 1600, the revival of science and the development of printing had led to widespread publication of astronomical maps, globes and books. In 1665, the Jesuit scholar Athos Kircher made the first world map, Mundus Subterranus, to show currents, volcanic phenomena and valleys, thematic categories. Cartography was born, but even as late as 1740, fewer than 120 places in the world had their coordinates accurately established. Cartographers simply marked off whole areas with the single word unexplored. There's a footnote here. The power of print has been seen by the fact that the naming of America of the Florentine banker Amerigo Vespucci rather than Columbus seems to be originated in the woodcut globe of 1708. That's really interesting about maps. And so plain sailing is, I'm sailing on a flat piece of paper. A French charter of 1753, 15 years before James Cook set sail on the Endeavour, shows dotted shorelines accompanying the words, je suppose, I think. It is interesting. Perhaps in the part for that reason, throughout Western Europe, astronomy was viewed not so much as a science that describes the universe, but an aid to navigation, a word which, taken from the Latin navis and agria, to drive, ship driving, for centuries. Oh, navis, gear, driving, navigation, ship driving, for centuries meant demanding art of conducting ships across the sea. Astronomy was the first state science, and then the story told that King Charles II learned from his pillow talk of a mistress of a seagoing, from seagoing Brittany, that Frenchmen had devised a method of using the positions of the moon to determine the longitude of the sea. Remember that, though scant evidence for this, Charles decided that to seize the maritime initiative, he would invest in the latest astronomical technology, and in 1675 established the Royal Observatory at Greenwich. Navigation had already become so much part of the English consciousness that the poet laureate John Dryden would look back on the progress Annus Mirabilis in the Year of Wonders, 1666. Rude as their ships was navigation then, no useful compass or meridian known coasting. They kept the land within their ken and knew no north but when the pole star shone. Of all since have used the open sea that the bold English none were famed will have won. Beyond the year and out of heaven's way, they make discoveries where they see no sun. Nonetheless, during the Third Dutch Anglo War, 1672-4, the English Navy ran off poor performance as ascribed to low-level astronomical data available to enable sea captains to navigate and manoeuvre efficiently. And, well, it's interesting because then they just went completely over-the-top English getting seas and maps. In 1731, John Hadley, Fellow of the Royal Society, and John Jeffrey, a Philadelphia glazier, independently invented the reflecting quadrant, or octant, which is a 45 degrees arc divided into 90 parts, the end of the arc being joined by two arms. I'll have to really understand that. In 1757, John Campbell made the instrument less cumbersome by enlarging it to 1/6 sixteenth of a circle. But an instrument that was itself circular and more accurate by adding filters and a telescope. Well, there you go. There's an astrolabe, an octant, which is 45 degrees, sextants is 60 degrees. I don't quite understand it. a quadrant, an octant, and a sextant. Okay. Well into the 19th century, despite the profusion of instruments, observatories, and maps, there continued to be times when the sun was all that sailors had to go by. At one point, in Moby Dick, first published in the UK in 1851 as The Whale, Captain Ahab grazes through the ship's quadrant, waiting for the sun to reach the meridian. He starts to rant at the strange equipment. His output reflects a ship's company's mix with awe and anger at the sun's power, their doubts about how much science could ever help them, and their dreaded belief that they might lose their way forever. Foolish toy, baby playthings of haughty admirals and commodores and captains, the world breaks of thy cunning and their might. But what after all thou can do but tell the poor pitiful point that thou thyself hast to be on the wide planet, and the hands that hold thee know not one jot more. Thou canst not tell where to drop of water or one grain of sand will be tomorrow noon. And yet thy impotence, thou insultest the sun, science curse thee, vain thou vain toy. Ahab well understood how fallible such toys could be. There's a footnote. During the Second World War, the Sahara colossal deposits of iron ore seriously misdirected soldiers. Soldiers had to go back to working their positions by the sun. Well, there you go. Isn't that interesting? Later in the narrative, our obsessed captain asks his helmsman how the ship is heading and is told east. East, southeast. Thou liest, says Ahab, smiting his man with a fist. But he put the consults of the two compasses, and they were both points east, even though Pewick was going west. The man was rigid and laughed, explained, I have it. It happened to be before Mr. Starbuck last night thunder turned our compasses, that's all. So this Starbucks. Okay, well, how many pages? Oh, not too many pages here. The Heavenly Guide is very interesting. Ahab is up to the task. He seizes the steel rod from the steel's rigging and hands it to the mate with the word to hold it upright. Without touching the deck, he re-magnetizes the needle of the earth's field with a few well-directed hammer blows before taking out the needles from the binnacle and suspending one over the compass card. When finally it settles, it points at it and explains, look ye for yourselves, if Ahab be not lord of the level lodestone, the sun is east, the compass swears him. Because even the best compasses could be temperamental, the most modern instruments faulty, science has always been looking for better ways to measure. In the 18th century, the search was focused on the need for more accurate determination of the longitude. While the measurement of latitude, north-south positioning, was relatively simple, longitude, east-west positioning, which relied on which is most easily measured as a function of time, was a far greater challenge. The Dipple ship's clock in the early 17th century was accurate to no better than a few minutes a day, which after several days could mean a miscalculation of several miles. In her book, Longitude, Delva Sabel reminds us that the blood price for poor navigation. Sir Chowdhury Shuttle returned to England in 1707 from having captured Gibraltar 3 years before, piled four of his ships directly onto the Isles of Sicily at the far south of Sicily, the southwest of England. He thought he was safely rounding the coast of Brittany about 120 miles to the west. 1,600 of his men perished with him. The stock was so great that a disaster so close to home aroused the Parliament to establish the 1714 a Pacific Board of Longitude, and so a $20,000 prize for the accurate determination of longitude. Well, there you go. So that was the thing. So he didn't know where he was. So he saw something and thought it was far west. So he saw England and thought it was France and crashed into it. As early as 1610, 1810, Galileo proposed optimistically that absolute time could be measured from the points on the Earth's bearings from the moons of Jupiter, and he even devised a helmet with a telescope attached to the observer could dome when seated in its chair in what he would call gimbals, similar to those used in the ship's compass horizontal. This proved effective for surveying distances on land, but never worked at sea. Around 1710, a Yorkshireman, Terry Thacker, introduced the word chronometer into the English language. In Gulliver's Travels, published in 1726, Gulliver imagined himself living so long that I should see the discovery of longitude, the perpetual motion, the universal medicine, and many other great inventions brought to the utmost perfection. And Gulliver's Travel is so interesting because it's linked to the Francis Bacon thing. I've really got to really restudy Robert Bacon. To Swift, an accurate measurement of longitude obviously seemed about as impossible as any of the miles on the list. Not one of those who, I must admit, I should say that I have suffered the same thing. I have said, look, no one's ever going to produce a blue LED. I had a list of things that you couldn't do. So I'm not so critical of Swift. Not to those who entered the competition, however, ever. In theory, the problem sounded simple. One had to compare the local time with the time at a given place, such as Paris or Greenwich, relying on regular clockwork nature of the motions of the heavenly bodies to make easy mathematical calculations. But to do that, one had to produce a clock that could maintain accurate time on a long, rough voyage with varying conditions of temperature, pressure and humidity. In 1736, suitably motivated by the Hatzer Prize of 20,000, then worth nearly 3 million today, John Harrison, who died in 1776, a lowly clockmaker, unveiled his marine timekeeper, or sea clock, accurate to a tenth of a second per day. The board set up specifically to assess the Clambers Prize granted Harrison £500 for further development. In 1579, he came up with an even better version, a succession of hardly portable clocks he called watches. Hardy, a term taken from the practice of dividing the ship's day up into six watches and four each. That's the origin of the word watch. So plain sailing is, I can sail on a map. Okay? And a watch comes from the ship's watch. Unfortunately for him, the board was dominated by well-established professional astronomers who refused to believe that a man so modest a background could have accomplished such a feat, handing over but half the prize, and that much only in 1665, more than 3 years after the test had shown his invention had lost just 5.1 seconds over 80 days at sea. In 1773, Cook took the resolution in one of its first crossings through the Antarctic Circle. Among the voyages, single accomplishments was the vindication of the chronometer based on one of Hudson's models. They all took it, and he even took it different. Then by the time the magnitude of his achievement was finally recognised, Harrison had but 3 years to live. In 1884, almost a century of nearly every great nation's running the meridian from the time was calculated through its own calculator, capital. A conference in Washington awarded the prime meridian to England. The consideration that tipped the scales being that Greenwich had developed the necessary instrumental facilities and compiled observational data for over 200 years. By then, the jingoistic poet William Watson, who died in 35, put his ode to the coronation of King Edward the 7th. Time and the oceans and some foster star in high Canterbury have made us what we are. But the development of the prime meridian is more than a story of a sailor and the use of the sun. It's part of the whole history of timekeeping and how the sun was put to measure its own passing. Okay, and there's, we're about to finish this off. In 1740, 44, one of England's wars with Spain, six British ships under the Commodore George Arson set out to circumnavigate the globe. Arson's map of his journey movingly shows what befell his force without knowledge of longitude, the east-west position, the strokely thin line to the west of the continent, Drexel Squadron's progress. Only one ship, 500 men out of 1,900, completed the voyage. The charts were typically placed at John Furness, 217 kilometres west of Valparaiso in South America coast. In fact, it is 580 kilometres west, unsure of his maps. Arson set off in the wrong direction. By the time he reversed his course, it took 9 days to reach the starting point, during which 70 men died. Well, this is amazing. It's the most amazing. What the heck? It's just completely, it's just sickening to watch it. So I don't understand. There's Francis Drake, who circumnavigated the world, the globe. I just don't understand quite what's going on. Okay, so this is the heavenly guide. This is the sun and navigation. You just see that he's got general topics and he just dives into it, which is a real great relief. I think there is this risk of the overly academic, and that's not him. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.